to We the People. On this special edition, our guest today is an eminent economist, an eminent public intellectual, and of course, always an argumentative Indian. He's also a Nobel laureate who's used to grabbing the headlines for one reason or the other. The headline this time should have been about his new book that's just out, The Country of First Boys. Instead, over the past week, we have seen a fierce and healthy public debate in the editorial pages of several prominent newspapers and across television channels after Professor Amartya Sen wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books talking about government interference in educational institutions, not least his experience with Nalanda University. That editorial sparked a series of counter-editorials which Professor Sen himself has also been countering. So as we say, it is symptomatic of all of us being argumentative Indians, and it is my great pleasure to welcome on We the People our guest today, who will be taking questions not just from his critics, but also from young students from colleges and institutes across Delhi. Please welcome Professor Amartya Sen to We the People.
Thank you.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Did you think at this stage in your life would be a little quieter, that you wouldn't be at the center of so many storms? Does it surprise you that everybody is still debating Amartya Sen?
I don't know that they're debating Amartya Sen. They're debating some issue that I tried to raise.
Yes.
If they were debating Amartya Sen, I would have been rather depressed. But if they're discussing issues that I try to raise,
yes,
well, that must be a good thing.
The issue which is really at the center of all of these conversations is your larger impression that there is not just government interference in educational institutions, but almost an ideological interference in key educational roles. You've had eminent people like Pratap Bhanu Mehta argue back and say, all governments have always interfered in educational institutions. Why have you spoken up only about the Modi government?
Well, because first of all, I've spoken up again and again with the previous government as well, whether it be at the center or at the state, like the decimation of Presidency College in Calcutta. But I think there are two things here. To say that there have been interferences before and we didn't protest then, and therefore we mustn't protest now, I think it would be a silly argument. I don't think Pratap is presenting that. Secondly, I think many of us, of course, have protested in the past a number of times on a number of occasions, state and center. Thirdly, I think the idea is that there's certain types of interferences, like with the National Book Trust, the Indian Council of Cultural Relations, Indian Council of Historical Research, have had a feature where people are placed in positions of office in a political way. I mean, what has used to be a merely inefficient irritation has often ended up becoming a more systematic interference.
But you know, even Pratap Bhanu Mehta quotes this, and it's often been debated that in the Arjun Singh years, when he was the Human Resources Development Minister, or Kapil Sibal as HRD Minister, there too there was ideological placement of people that the government believed to have affinity with. It was just more left of centre, now it's more right of centre. The argument being that people like yourselves did not speak up about the politicization of education, but it was a different ideology.
Why do you say people like us didn't speak up? Many of us are on record of having taken different positions, a strong position against some of these interferences. You know, I think there are two confusions here.
Yes.
I'm not accusing Pratap, you're summarizing Pratap.
Yes.
One is that if we haven't done the right thing in the past, we should never do the right thing again. That's a silly argument, because if we fail to make the right kind of protest, which I'm not accepting we did, but if we had, to say that therefore everything is fine, I think that's not the way to run any government.
So give us.
Secondly, there are two points. The idea that the nature of the government interference that you're seeing,
yes,
under the Hindutva regime does not have a political color of a consistent kind. I mean, Arjun Singh, the examples you're giving.
Yes.
There were quite a lot of inefficiencies involved in that, certainly. But this whole idea that there is a certain general approach which is being imposed, which you see in all kinds of places. IIMs being told,
yes,
that they that these will be direct appointees of the government. And so on. To say that there is no difference between the past and the present isn't right either. But my point is, if we had failed miserably to have protested before, that is not an argument for not protesting now.
You have even suggested, Professor Sen, that there is a, you know, that one of the reasons you stood up on the Nalanda University issue, though the government may well have preferred that you skulked out in silence, that's what you said to the Indian Express, is because you did not want a Hindutva ideologue to be put in a position of authority in Nalanda. Was that fear exaggerated or misplaced, given that the person who's going to take over in your role is somebody who can hardly be described as that? He's, you know.
Well, the question is how to ensure that he would come to that position. There is, I'm intimated that the government would not like me to continue. I think it's very unfortunate that in the present debate, perhaps because of the headline of the paper that first reported that in this occasion,
yes,
they were mentioning I was ousted. But this is not the issue. I was ousted in January.
Yes.
And that's not the issue. The issue is, what's the replacement? So the argument that as soon as it became clear to me that even if I, you see, the board had unanimously wanted me to stay on, so I said stop the fight, because even if I succeed, even if they agree to my being Chancellor, I would never have the power, the effectiveness of the Chancellor.
I know, but why have you...
And therefore, I wanted, I'm answering your question, in fact, and you may not think that, but I am. And therefore, we have to get someone who the government will accept and would see that given the amount of furore that took place, there was a lot of mud thrown at me, and
yes,
they're going to be there. That was inevitable in social media. Some of the ones like that, I should be killed limb by limb, seems a little bit exaggerated as a resolve in the political arena, but I expected that. On the other hand, editorial and counter-editorial, absolutely every editorial that was published was critical of the government in this occasion. I don't know, they might have been in Pioneer, which I hadn't read, but the issue was therefore to make it into a discussable question. You know, I'm proud of being a citizen of a democracy. It's a lot of problem with that. Right now I'm suffering from the problem that the passport, my old expired one, which shows that I live in England, I have right to live in England, I left behind in Shantiniketan, and somebody is trying to fetch it. I cannot enter England without it, even though I've been master of a college, I may be a companion of honor of the Queen. Nevertheless, I cannot because I hold an Indian passport. Now, the reason for doing it is because I'm proud of being a citizen of a democracy. Now, in democracy, if you want to get something done, how do you do it? Now, some people advise the government. I had a debate with Tavleen Singh. I've never been an advisor of any government whatsoever. As a citizen of a democracy, when it comes to India, I place it in the public media. So I raise this issue because in democracy, the way to make a change is through public discussion.
Okay.
So you're asking me, you of all people, meant to be an anchor of the media for India, asking me why did I make it a public issue?
No, I didn't ask you that. I was asking you, there is one issue which is about government interference, governments wanting their own people. But I read you saying that if I hadn't stood up, they may have placed a Hindutva ideologue in a key role in Nalanda. So I am wondering why you're seeing an ideological connection as opposed to just government interference.
That's a government mess.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because there were a number of things happening at about the same time. National Book Trust happened a bit later, but there were things like Indian Council of Cultural Relations, Indian
yes.
Council of Historical Research. We know that the head of the Indian Council of Historical Research believed that the caste system was in many ways a pretty good thing. We know the Indian Council of Cultural Relations even has quoted that Mr. Modi is a bigger figure in some ways than Mahatma Gandhi, and that Mr. Modi may well be reincarnation of God. I felt almost begin a court case saying that in order for God to be reincarnated, he had to die. And that seemed to me a blasphemous thing to say. And as a Hindu, my God, I protest against it. I could have. So I think there are things happening. You know, we don't live in a world That consists of Nalanda in its 17 square miles area.
Okay, let's start taking questions. Anupriya, please stand and ask your question. Yes.
So my question was that had you expected interference from the government, or was this interference already there? And either way, do you think that by withdrawing your position as chancellor, you stood up for against this interference, and did you show it as resistance to it, or did you just avoid that entire scene and it could have been handled in a better way?
I did not actually. Nalanda had so far proceeded up to that point on an all-party agreement. And in fact, when a book edited by Wendy Doniger, whose book Hindu was pulped on the charge, I mean, we live in a world where other things are happening even outside Nalanda, and we can watch them. When that book had to be published because Penguin lost nerve. That time, Wendy Doniger also produced a book on Indian secularism. I wrote an article there. And in the article I said that the Indian government speaks with many voices. And as far as the Minister of External Affairs is concerned, and particularly the Minister Sushma Swaraj is concerned, I have seen no evidence whatsoever that she wants to interfere in this matter. And that's in book. That, by the way, you can pick it up in Calm Market. Therefore, I would say that there are parts of the government which are not in that direction. Given the fact that it is a Hindutva government, it is good that there are parts of the government which don't seem to be proceeding that way. There were interferences before, like the statutes which were placed, were passed unanimously by the board, were not placed to the president, the visitor, to sign. There was an attempt to change the board, suddenly overlooking the Indian Parliamentary Act. So there was that. But on the other hand, I thought that the minister was being very friendly. She, in fact, came to the board meeting. And therefore, I'm on record saying that I expected that that would continue. So when it happened, when I was suddenly told that the rumor was, obviously the president cannot deny or accept it, but the rumor was, and it's fairly well-placed sources, that the president has been told that he is not in a position to sign it because he represents the government, and therefore I'm not acceptable. Now that came, did it come to me as a surprise? Yes. Did it break my heart? I've been working since the age of 11, when I first went there.
Well, so did it break your heart?
Well, it somebody did, and you know, we have kind of layers of heart, a bit maybe broken and the other bit gone, ticking along fine.
can I ask you before?
But I have to answer just a short question. That my thought then was, okay, that episode is over. There's no point in fighting because the government, they've already shown they don't want to accept the statutes and so on. I want someone who could get from the guarantee from the government that there would be no interference. And my successor, who is an excellent guy, Giorgio, has got this guarantee. That whole question would not have come up if this had not become a publicly discussed issue. I do not apologize as a citizen of India making any question that interests me a public issue.
People have written since this issue erupted that someone like former President Kalam had differences with you on your choice of vice-chancellor.
That is just not true. Kalam wrote to us a letter.
Yes.
Saying that the post is meant for the President of India.
The vice-chancellor post.
No, not the vice-chancellor. You're confusing there. Visitor. There's the vice-chancellor,
right.
there's the chancellor. There's the visitor.
But didn't he also have differences with your choice of vice-chancellor?
No, never. We have never heard of him on that subject at all. As visitor, he wrote to us saying, the visitor is meant to be the President of India. When the idea was raised, when I wrote to him saying that, would you please assume this position, he said that the position should now be occupied by the present president, namely Pratibha Patel.
Yes.
And we wrote to her, and she agreed. You see, the newspaper constructed a huge number of stories, namely that Kalam was critical of the
Vice-Chancellor,
which is not the case. First of all, it would have been odd, because there was a selection committee, there was a unanimous decision of the board, they will say that he's left in disgust, which is not the case. He left because he's no longer president. I think that the idea that we spent 3,000 crores of rupees.
Yeah, 2,700 crores is the number 27. Cited.
Yes. Actually, we spent 46 crores altogether from the beginning of the university until the end of the last financial year. So that's a lie. I was told, it was told that the chancellor gets a salary of 50 lakhs of rupees, which is a lie. We don't get a salary.
Questions were also asked about, you know, A, why you chose the vice chancellor you didn't, B, why you gave her a certain financial package which was seen to be inflated.
I didn't, but you know, you asking these questions, I don't know who, but you see...
No, I'm just reading articles that have come out in newspapers.
The only, you see, the point is this, the one difficulty I had with Pratap. You see, I got a flood of letters supporting, and when Pratap's article said the reaction to him had been ugly, reaction in the social media of a particular group who are trying to decide whether it's better to tear me limb by limb or just kill me at one go. If they say that the amount spent is this much and he gets such and such, such and such salary, which are all lies, to take that to be a serious question to ask in an NDTV interview rather than editorial from Telegraph to Deccan
Herald. No, I'm quoting from an Indian Express article by Ashok Malik.
That was the one article
yes.
that was written. Ashok Malik was the one fairly respectable journalist, but it was full of errors which were corrected, including the amount spent, 27, the amount she didn't inquire, it is 46 now, at that time it was less than that. If some reputable journalist lent his name to false stories, to say, therefore, that it becomes true.
No, I'm not just asking.
You're asking, but you're asking questions only of that kind. You're not asking questions, editorials in Telegraph or the Deccan Herald.
No, we're going to move to all of those issues, Professor.
But these are all supportive ones. So the whole idea...
We're just having a good argument, as you
You're having an excellent argument, excepting the argument has to take into account the fact that compared with every letter... even those which who don't want to kill me, in every letter attacking, there are at least 25 letters I've got in support.
I agree. And Professor Sen, how did you deal with these threats that came on social media? You know, you've mentioned twice that they were ugly enough to talk about, you know, life-threatening messages.
No, they're
almost.
Not life-threatening.
Breaking you up by tearing you up limb by limb, what is that?
If people who are going to break you up limb by limb don't usually go in the press saying that they're going to break you up limb by limb. So, did I feel threatened? No.
What did you feel?
It's very unfortunate that the debate had descended to that level.
Yes.
But that was not unknown to me. That's been true. When I wrote originally, after the Babri Masjid was destroyed, an article in the same journal, in the New York Review,
yes.
called Threats to Indian Secularism, I used to get 600 attacks every week. And they could be classified. Type A says this thing, type B, type C, type D. And my secretary would say, no, this is the type D attack. I mean, and you could see they're reproducing the same language often. You see, I'm a great believer in press freedom. The press freedom includes the social media, includes people saying pretty unpleasant things. But as a Democrat, I defend their right to say those things. But we also have the right to speak against it.
Of course.
If anchors like you concentrate only on those and not on the supporting letter,
no.
I don't think you're serving the Indian public
that's,
well.
That's not true. As you know, when this controversy erupted, I was among the first to actually interview you and publish the letters you wrote. So it's not that I would disregard the fact that this created a huge debate with many people standing up in support. Of course. I was just presenting a set of contrarian questions. I know when the controversy erupted.
Contrarian questions are very good if they're in the context, if it played, you see, I think the difficulty, you know, there's a time, this is actually relates also a bit to Pratap Bhanu's article, who's also an old friend of mine. You see, at the time, I'm not making any comparison, for God's sake, make it quite clear, no comparison between Modi and Mussolini. But when the fascism was coming into Italy, you find the paper saying, in the past there have been a lot of interference. Why are you so worried about Mr. Mussolini? Yeah. What's he going to do? Other thing says, there's so much criticism of the past government. Same thing happened in Germany about the Weimar Republic. Yeah. The point is that a newspaper has to have a balance as to which way the public are thinking. If there are some issues that people find dangerous, like the rise of a, and there's no comparison between Hindutva and fascism or Nazism at all, and let me make it absolutely clear so that that's not distorted.
There are misplaced headlines of that, yes.
But if there is something new happening, to say that in the past there have been interference, often of an extremely inefficient kind, that is to confuse the debate as to whether there is an organized movement. I believe there's an organized movement right now called the Hindutva Movement. Lots of the RSS people, they're former members in the Indian Council of Historical Research, who are members. The editor of the the director of the National Book Fund is a former editor of Panchajana, which is an RSS mouthpiece. If you don't see any pattern in that, and saying what's the problem?
It's, no, I think a lot of us have been missing.
Saying it. But I think lots of people read the Fotampano article in that language. Also, when he says, attack, since Amasya sent the article, the Indian reaction has been ugly. That's nonsense. 25 out of 26 articles were...
in support.
Were support.
Agreed.
So they were not ugly. It was a small group of ugliness, but they could make themselves...
small and noisy.
And there's a lot to be learned from how fascism came in Italy. There's a famous story. Am I allowed to tell a story?
Yeah, okay.
There's a famous story when a fascist recruiter is trying to ask someone, saying, why don't you join fascist party? It's a great party. And he said, no, I can't join fascist party. Your arguments are excellent, but I can't. Because I'm a socialist. My father was a socialist. My grandfather was a socialist. I can't join fascist party. To which this man said, this is a very silly argument, says the fascist recruiter, very sensibly. There is no reason why you should be bound by that. Hmm. If your father had been a murderer, if your grandfather had been a murderer, what would you have done then? To which they said, then of course I would have joined the fascist party. So there are a lot of things in our mind which we may not be willing to say.
Okay, next question, Apurva. Apurva, yes.
Sir, with all due respect, whenever you've come to India, some controversy has come up. So is Dr. Amartya Sen a controversial Indian or an argumentative Indian?
I hope I'm controversial. because, you know, if you say things, I could say Mahatma Gandhi was a great person, and there would be no controversy. If you being, in addition to being a teacher, which is my main role, you also want to participate in public discussion, you ought to raise issues on which there is some differences. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Being controversial is not such a bad thing to happen.
Yes.
As being completely non-controversial.
Would be
if
boring.
Somebody said, oh gosh, you said that, it is totally non-controversial, they've said, you know, what a waste of time.
It's boring to be non-controversial. Okay, Venkat Raman?
My question to you is that you've always been a bit apprehensive about Modi's administration in the past. But given the fact that we have been doing pretty well in the last 12 months in terms of macroeconomic parameters and business sentiment in general, how do you rate the current central government's performance under the leadership of Mr. Modi?
I wish I could say that I rated very high because I, in many ways, I thought that there could be better things happening. I think part of the reason why it hasn't happened is that the Gujarat model is very deeply flawed. It's one of the worst traits about immunization, way below Bihar. It is one of the worst in terms of sex-selective abortion in basic education, all kinds of ways. The process of economic development has to have human beings at the center. And this is not a model that we got. And in some ways, Modi has tried to reproduce that, which has been unfortunate, rather than saying that, look, we're dealing with a bigger country at a different kind of point of view. You say it's been very successful. I mean, the biggest rates of growth in the country have been under UPA 1. The comparison is between UPA 1 and UPA 2. And the last couple of years, the numbers dropped a bit. And since then, they've got up a bit. And since the Chinese have dropped, and since the oil prices have fallen, India looks, relatively speaking, pretty good. And it's wonderful. We should celebrate that fact. But it's not something that could be seen as a greatly, heavily earned economic record. And the problem remains because there have been budget cuts, even for Sarvasikar Abhiyan, midday meals. to say that we are giving the money to the state. It doesn't quite do it. When the Finance Commission said states should have more money, it isn't to pick up the things that the center refuses to do. It was because the states could take new initiative. That's not happened. So I think if we see money being cut for those things which need most expansion, that's not progress. Okay. So how do I rate it? Unfortunately, not that well.
But let's take a question here, Revati.
Yeah. Sir, you're a great proponent of Sanskrit, but in today's day and age, how relevant is it to know Sanskrit? Like, wouldn't I be better equipped to know German or French or something regarding that?
And that is, of course, the whole debate with Smriti Irani's decision. And how do you see that entire question?
Well, there, I'm afraid I would be seen as a renegade. I think Sanskrit is very important. Sanskrit was my second language before English. Because it's mainly because my English was so dreadful. I went to
You don't believe that.
No, it's so. And, people are also concerned about English. I went to a Bengali medium school. Mm-hmm. I did all my studies in Bengali. My grandfather was a Sanskritist. I had to, from the age of 3, I've been doing Sanskrit. Panini changed my understanding of the world. It still does. Mm-hmm. My belief that ultimately all knowledge is systematic classification, is a Panini thought. My understanding of the Vedas, this enormous story, the big forces of nature, are there some godling controlling them, or is there one Godhead altogether? And then, in book 10, this agnostic thing, maybe there isn't anyone there. All this is in Vedas. Make one shake you up. Then there are also such things as the lament of the gambler. The gambler says, I know that gambling is wrong, but whenever it happens, I go out, end up there. I know it's terrible. My wife pushes me away. My mother-in-law does not like me expressing that kind of thought. And still I go. Why do I go? These are kind of behavior, what actually the Greeks would call it about the same time.
Is this the one?
All kinds of ways you get an understanding of India's past, and it's a very big part of the
Indian
past.
Would you support it being compulsory as a third language?
No, listen, there is a practical problem. People have to do mother tongue, Hindi, English. So Sanskrit becomes a sport.
Yeah.
So I think making compulsory would be too much. Now, given the fact that the question,
wouldn't I be better served doing German or French?
Well, I don't know about German and French. Certainly English would be a very important thing to do. I don't know that many businesses are conducted in German right now. Maybe in Europe, maybe in Greece they will do it in Germany.
Okay, let's take Yogendra Yadav's question. Yogendra Yadav, if we can bring up his question.
Sir, how do you see the future of secularism? On the one hand, we have a government, a regime, which is out and out majoritarian. On the other hand, we have secularists who use blatant vote bank politics of using minorities as hostage. On the one hand, we have those who want to celebrate anything to do with India, right or wrong. On the other, we have modern people who know nothing about our traditions, nothing about our culture.
I don't think we have to reinvent secularism, because I think we have had a long tradition of secular thinking, and it's not just something that happened at the time of independence. Secularism present even in Bhagavad Gita. I think there's a long history. Now, the fact that in politics secularism has been used for vote bank, very regrettable. The fact that there is out-and-out attack on it, it's also very regrettable.
I think what Yogendra is saying is, do we need a different idiom? Because the traditional secularists are deracinated.
I don't know what you mean by traditional secularism. To me, secularism is like Mahatma Gandhi. Having evening prayers every day, and at the same time insisting that Congress remains completely above any religious differences. Now, I think we are inheritors of that thought, of the Tagore, of so many others in the making up. We don't have to invent anything. We have to make sure that those who try to use secularism or anti-secularism as World Bank politics do not get rewarded. That does require standing up for old values rather than creating new values. We have these values.
That's interesting. Okay, Surjeet, your old friend Surjeet Bhalla has a question for you.
I have questions pertaining to socio-economic policies in India over the last 65 years. The first policy pertains to the education policy that was pursued by Nehru. So do you think, in hindsight, the expansion of higher education at the expense of primary and secondary education, the path followed by most other developing countries, was correct? In other words, did we make a mistake in not expanding primary and secondary education in the 1950s and 60s?
Sujit, 1970, I gave an article, gave a lecture, which was widely reproduced, called Crisis in Indian Education. Mm. And I argued exactly that, namely we're overspending, relatively speaking, on higher education and vastly underspending on primary education. And the rots had started even earlier than 1970. And I think Nehru had many great things, including people don't appreciate that things like IITs were his creation. Yeah. And yet, I don't think he actually resonated on basic education, on elementary education. And in fact, Mahatma Gandhi, who also, I think, made a mistake in thinking basic education, he had an argument with Tagore on that. So I think the Congress's policy of education was dreadfully wrong. But where the only thing I'd object to on that subject is to say, in hindsight, it's not the hindsight. That was, I was writing about in 1950s, 1960s.
When I got
a Nobel, the Statesman was kind enough to republish some of them grumbling about. Indeed, somebody in 70s, already in 70s, saying, you're saying the same thing again and again. Do not worry about repeating yourself. Mm-hmm. What was I repeating? That we're ignoring primary education. My regret isn't that it, hindsight, because that was what I wanted then.
Yes.
That I had to repeat it today again, after 60 years. Yes.
Okay, we're told we have 5 minutes with you because you have a flight to catch, so I'm going to speed this up. I'll take one from a student here, Manav. Where is Manav? Yes.
In the past, you have said that the 1984 riots and the 2002 riots are not really comparable.
No, I didn't say that.
In the TOI article, you mentioned that.
Which where?
That the two riots are not really comparable.
No, I didn't say that. Anywhere.
And that, okay, and that the Congress leaders were not really responsible for the 84 riots.
Oh, nonsense. They were tremendously responsible.
I actually read it. Yeah.
How I don't know where you read that. I don't know. I think the riots were absolutely terrible. And in fact, I published something in argument with Tabling Singh.
Yes.
And I thought that it was shameful of the government not to pursue the criminals of Delhi at that time. What I said was that when you judge a party, you have to judge not only by that record, though those records were very comparable, and the fact that one of them meant to have been spontaneous on grounds that they were all outraged by Mrs. Gandhi's murder, is not a sufficiently good argument to distinguish that. But when you're judging about whom to vote for, you have to look only not only on that, but also, is there a history of Hindutva? Is there an RSS? Is there something else going on? Is Mr. Modi, as a Pracharak of RSS all his life, is he able to provide the right kind of leadership, and so on? That came up in the election, never the distinction between the two. As a matter of fact, I didn't say any Tabligh thing. I didn't vote for Rajiv Gandhi either. Mm. I was a minority in not voting for it. But certainly I did not make that statement. That you were attributing to me. So I'm delighted you said it, because I can tell you that that is not a statement I ever made, nor did I believe it.
So you're saying that while 84 and 2002 were both abhorrent, you see Narendra Modi differently from Rajiv Gandhi because of the history of his RSS
background. You know, I haven't voted for Rajiv Gandhi. Yeah. And Rajiv Gandhi wasn't standing for election last year, as far as I am aware. I was discussing Mr. Modi.
Yes.
In that context, I was saying that his being a Pracharak for RSS and RSS standing for something, even if you eliminate any responsibility they may have had or any connection in the murder of Mahatma Gandhi. I'm not raising that issue at all,
yeah.
and wiping that out, still makes me very worried about certain aspects of to what extent the communities will be treated symmetrically. Now, if Rajiv Gandhi was there, I may well have analyzed him differently. But that's not the exercise I was engaged in 2014. When that exercise I was engaged in the December of 1984, the very bad time, my wife was ill with cancer, and died shortly after that. So it was the time when I was not being very vocal, but I certainly didn't
vote for him.
Yeah.
Okay, we're racing against time. So Suhail Seth's question is next, your old friend from West Bengal. Suhail.
Professor Sen, good evening.
Good evening.
We normally meet in the salubrious environs of the Taj, Bengal, but here's a difference. I've always admired your writings, but of late, I also admire the manner in which you stir up a hornet's nest whenever you visited here. Now, increasingly, it's not your lectures, but it's what you say and how you react which makes the news. How do you feel being a celebrity controversialist? Tell me, do you really believe that this country, in its present state, is going to forgive you for your completely covert, earlier and overt now, leanings towards what we believe is a culture of the past, the Congress culture, the cronyism culture? I also believe that as an academic of your renown, a Nobel laureate to boot, do you really believe you want to get involved with spats involving the likes of a Sonia Gandhi or a Narendra Modi? Or do you believe you're still not above it?
Well, I'm certainly not above it as an Indian citizen and as an Indian voter. I stand in long queues to keep that, to keep my voting rights. Overseas citizenship would not do it. I do it because I want to participate in my country's future. And therefore, yes, now do I... I've often been told that I'm somehow connected with Sonia Gandhi. Actually, I respect her tremendously. I thought she did a terrific job in 2004 election.
Yes.
I met her, I think, 5 times. She's always been very kind to me. First time when Rajiv introduced this Italian lady who was his girlfriend, in Trinity College Avenue. I thought she was enormously impressive looking, though her English was fairly limited, so we didn't have much of a chat. She was very kind when I was given the Bharat Ratna to come there.
Yes.
After the Nobel, she gave me tea, and I think I met her 2 other times. Was it Shekhar who said, as a friend and advisor, this is before Tomlin thing.
Yes.
So actually, you know, that would have been a kind of ethereal influence if that were true. But yeah, I think there are many things. I think there are many things about her interest in education and healthcare which I applaud. There are many things. When Modi gave a speech from the top of the Red Fort and said all the right things, including toilets and so on, the fact that money for sanitation has been cut since then is unfortunate and doesn't quite tally with the speech. But the speech has had all kinds of good noises, and I'm not one of those who believe the speeches don't mean anything.
You know, one of the arguments the BJP has made is that when you spoke about the cuts in sanitation and other welfare programs, they argue that the share of tax revenues for the states has been increased.
No,
so the states have greater spending at their disposal.
But this is the confusion, really. When the Finance Commission said states should have more money,
yes,
this was a new initiative.
Yes.
Not for those things that the center used to do and now don't do it. Number two, there's no way of guaranteeing that the states would do it. And one of the things we know in India is that the records are very uneven, from Kerala and Himachal and Tamil Nadu on one side to a number of other states, which
yes.
I won't name, on the other. So I think this whole idea, the center has no responsibility, somehow we give the money to the state and we cut down these things, that is not an appropriate argument. That may be a way of presenting the budget, but it is not a very good way of either being fair to the Finance Commission or saying that the money has not been cut, because it has been cut.
What about programs like Jan Dhan or Skill, you know?
Taking everything into account, India spends incredibly little on public services. India is the way out. You see, this is the big thing. Asia has survived on a magic of combining market economy, which is very important, with good public services.
Yes.
Began in Japan after Meiji Restoration 1868.
Yes.
When they, Hideyoshi being one of them, asking, why is it that Americans are more productive than we are? But mainly he said, because they're educated, we are not. They have health care, which we don't have, true at that time. So in 40 years, they become fully literate. Then Japan takes the leadership. We are the way out. If you compare the public service money we spend, we stand comparable to some of the worst African countries.
Yes.
And our record in undernourishment, immunization,
is worse than some of the African countries.
Indeed. Bangladesh has 96% total immunization. We are hovering around 65%. To say that, you know, we have got, you know, all these names you were rattling, so we forgive
one name, Jan Dhan. I asked you about Jan Dhan.
But all the names put together doesn't still make up what is not being done.
One last question. Lots of hands. I don't know how long we can keep you here. Devansh, okay.
Yeah. So my question to you is, so the caste census figures haven't been put out by the government as yet. And so there are some allegations that the reason is a fear of backlash from the backward communities and the increase in the socioeconomic disparities. So what is your take on that? And sir, how essential really are these figures for the government planning?
Well, I haven't studied it. I don't know that particular debate. I saw yesterday that from Niti Yoga, I think Panagaria was...
We'll be heading a panel to study it.
In charge of that. I hope that he makes a good job of that. I don't really know. You know, I'm always very flattered when people assume that I know a lot more than I do. In this case, I cannot actually. When you find out, let me know.
Okay. Last question from industrialist Sunil Alag.
Yeah. I just want to ask one question, because you seem to highlight on every occasion that no economic growth is possible without it being broad-based, and it must go down to the poorest person. And nobody can argue against that. But what I want to ask you is that I've never seen you highlight what are the trade-offs that are required at the margin to achieve this. For instance, if you need to set up a cement factory, you need to set up a steel factory, to build roads, to build houses, it all appears to be, in your mind, pro-capitalist. And I seem to think that you're probably aware of it, but I've never seen you highlight it, and I fear perhaps that we all need to see what you think about this.
That's a good question. I've never used the word capitalist or pro-capitalist in that context at all, in fact. I don't think there is a trade-off, really, because if you're setting up a cement factory, you still want to have people to produce things according to specification, quality control, and so on. For that, you need literacy to be able to count. I think if the Chinese can maintain a much higher level of growth for decades in a way that we came under UPA-1 and then collapsed there, but not quite collapsed, but came down. I think one of the big differences is that the Chinese have a literate and basically healthy labor force, which you see in longevity, mortality rate. India is the first country which is trying to become an industrial giant with an unhealthy, uneducated labor force. It has not been done before, cannot be done now, and there isn't any trade-off in that. And to say pro-capitalist is, I think, a mistake, because this is not a case. You see, the big influence in my life in terms of thinking is Adam Smith.
Yes.
And in that context, there are a lot of things which are in the interest of the business, is in the interest of the people as well. And this is one of them.
And there's no contradiction there.
There may be some subject when there are, when it comes tax rate, etc. But not generally. The whole idea of education and healthcare, the big thing about the Asian, the lesson of Asian experience is that market economy and good public services happen to be pro-pro, because these are the people who suffer most from not having public health care can go very well together. That's my point.
Okay. Professor Sen has a flight to catch. We have 30 seconds on the show, so 10 seconds for your last question.
Professor, you've strongly advocated and made a very strong case for increasing public spending. Isn't cutting down on the leakages more important than actually increasing the amount of public spending? Isn't delivery more important than the percentage?
I think both are very important. Even with leakages, if we spend about 1% of GDP on government health care, and China spends 3%, and Thailand spends more, and so on, then leakage or not, we are not doing it. Now, on top of that, that 1% may end up being only 0.5% because of leakages. So I think one of the things, and I'm very glad you asked the question, it's a good question to end in, since as Barkha keeps saying, I have a flight to catch.
I keep getting told that I have to release
you. Everyone would have gone away saying, what did you learn that Sen had a flight to catch? So that the... It's very unfortunate to say, is this good, is this bad, is this more important than the other? If there are many defects, you have to approach them together. It's not like saying, is vitamin more important than having protein? We got to have both, actually. So I would say leakages, yes, enormous problem. And overall allocation being very skimpy, not understanding the role of public health care, and since the question Mr. Jain raised about pro-capitalist comes in, Adam Smith is thought to be the person who taught the world about how the market economy works, and where he says we want economic good political economy for two reasons. It increases the income of the individuals, and two, because it increases the income of, as he put it, state or the commonwealth. So they can provide the public services which the state alone can provide. That's the thing to recognize.
I will, on this note, have to say goodbye to you. Okay. Otherwise, you will really miss this flight. Okay. Thank you, Professor Sen.
Thank you very much.
It is always a pleasure to have you on the program. And we always walk away from learning something and also having something to think about. And I think here's to more arguments. Because what's the fun of life without that? Let's say thank you.